RN is also a great read. Find feature articles online at our homepage.
And hello, welcome to Life Matters on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell joining you this morning. Congratulations if your team won this weekend. Commiserations if your team lost. And if you're totally oblivious to the events of the last weekend in September, hope it was a good one for you anyway. A really extraordinary story this morning from investigative journalist Jenny Nordberg. The Underground Girls of Kabul. Really not to be missed. It's a shift the skin you're in type of story, let me tell you. I was blown away by her book and the stories that she's unearthed. Susan Mousehart is back to surprise us and delight us with her How Did That Become a Thing series. She's calling them little histories of the stuff we take for granted, and I love today's episode. Oddly enough, it's about Borden. Tweet us at RN Life Matters. Schooling is in need of a radical makeover, argues my first guest this morning. Oh, God, no, I hear you say, didn't we try that with Gonski, the national curriculum, now Christopher Pine's review of that national curriculum, NAPLAN testing, what now? Richard Gerver is a leading British educator. He's speaking at an education conference kicking off this week in Melbourne. He's the author of Creating Tomorrow's Schools Today. He's been enormously creative in his own approach as a former headmaster. So we wanted to find out, what do tomorrow's schools need to look like, according to Richard? And he joins us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
A fixation on the past. This is your concern about schooling systems in your country and mine. In what way do you believe we are fixated on the past?
Well, I think we've been through, as you said in your introduction, endless new initiatives through maybe the last 30, 40 years, certainly accelerating in the last 10 or 15. But none of them have actually stood back and looked at how we need to revision education. They've really just been about how do we make the existing system more efficient. So for me, the critical thing we need to do is to take a step back, take a deep breath, and rather than keep delivering endless reactive policies to try and fix a system that, in essence, I don't believe is any longer fit for purpose, we need actually to ask a big, much more detailed question about what exactly is the future of education best based on what our kids need to be and how they need to behave.
Just before we, though, come to some of those solutions, let's get some examples from you for why you think schooling is not fit for purpose, is not fit for the future, is fixated on the past.
Okay, well, let me give you an example. I had the most extraordinary privilege not that long ago to spend some time with Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple, who, incidentally, after leaving Apple, spent a couple of years working as a state school teacher. The world didn't know that until now. But he spent a couple of years working in a local state school near San Francisco.
Lucky them.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine that, boys and girls, your new technology teacher, Steve Wozniak? But we were talking about education, and something he said, I think, put it really eloquently and elegantly for me. He said, you know, the world spends so much time fixating on what it is we should teach our children. He said, the truth is, that's largely irrelevant. What really matters is how they learn. And I think that in crux is the challenge that we're facing. You know, the traditional system is all about filling our kids up with content. Mm. And the reality is, we've got to develop an education system where they're capable not only of learning for themselves, but being passionate about learning through their lives.
Oh, it sounds so ideal. Let's embed it in an example, and we'll cut to the chase. Tell me about Grange Primary School, where you were a principal. You really radically shifted the culture in that school, didn't you? Where did you start?
Yep. Well, the school had been in serial decline for about 10 years. They'd had numerous school principals, the last of whom had been off. There'd been no principal for 18 months. They were a typical state school in trouble, you know, where people would parachute in, give them the latest thinking, the latest policies, the latest ideas. And all of that was kind of built on top of everything they were already doing. So we started by asking one critical question, which was, forget all of that for the moment. What do we want our children to look like as human beings when they leave us? We then developed a kind of pupil profile based on that philosophy. We then meshed onto that the, I think, common sense belief that children learn best when the learning is rich in context and experience. So we then set about designing an education system that met the vision for developing those human beings, which incidentally included core skills in literacy and numeracy and science and other valuable and highly important skill sets, and then created a system based on that model of, core skills.
I want to bring that alive even further, though. The four core strands of your curriculum became communication, enterprise, culture, well-being. I'm not seeing literacy, numeracy. Like, where are those good, solid, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic?
Yep. Well, three of the four strands had core subjects at their heart. So at the heart of communication was literacy. At the heart of enterprise, although enterprise is far more expansive than this, was the core subject of numeracy. And at the heart of culture was science. You know, our belief that culture is all about an awareness of our world, how it fits together, how it works, and where we come from. So science was at the heart of that. And then the well-being strand was split into three separate areas: social well-being, physical well-being, and spiritual well-being. But hopefully you can see then, when you start to break those strands down, that the entire curriculum is built in with that. But what you're doing is creating a much more contextual and kind of logical link to the way they fit together.
Is it? Because there is a strong case being made in Australia that we need to go back to first principles again, that we've got a little bit too postmodern in our curriculum.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is all that creative thinking behind the scenes lost on the kids?
No. I mean, I think we have to be very careful here. I think, as say, we've had endless new initiatives, some of them that have been very retro and sort of very traditional. Some have been very forward thinking. Partly my concern is because of this, we've actually overcomplicated education. And when we talk about stripping it backwards, what we've got to do is stop lurching from the past to the future to the present. You know, what we actually have to do is understand that if you're going to teach literacy and numeracy and science, which of course are vital core elements of any child's skills armory, you have to do it in such a way that those skills mean something to kids. And teaching them in discrete blocks is a very abstract concept for most young people. And the real tragedy is you don't then see them being able to apply those skills in real life contexts outside of the academic forum.
Okay, Richard Gerver is my guest this morning. He's a leading British educator and education analyst. He's a former headmaster. He's the author of Creating Tomorrow's Schools Today. So what you did in your primary school was create a town, and it was called Grangeton. Tell us about that town and what its purpose was.
Sure. Well, we were always fascinated by how powerful early years education is in its best context. You know, an early years education is founded on hugely skilled professionals planning in great detail, but delivering a very experiential curriculum, often based around role play. So we decided that we should move that right the way through the primary phase. And the town consisted of all the elements that you'd find in any real society, but, you know, which, like any real society, required you to have core skills to be able to function not just efficiently, but to thrive in that kind of community. So we had a political system with a democratically elected mayor and cabinet.
So the kids are the players here.
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. And what we did was we brought in real life experts, if you like, to train the children to run these enterprises. So with our political system, we had a member of parliament from the British Parliament take the kids to Westminster to hang out down there to learn about political representation.
Poor things.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what.
Deluded they came back, before they finished primary school.
They came back and actually turned round to me and said, you know what, sir? Our behaviour is a lot better than those grown-ups down at parliament. So
they'd be right there. But it wasn't just the political process, was it?
No.
There was more to this town.
Oh, yeah. They had their own television station, radio studio. They had cafes, shops, museums. The idea was to replicate everything you would find in, an adult society and give the children the opportunity to run and manage an entire micro community. And that micro community ran every day of the school year, every week of the school year. Although it required quite significant adult investment in time and training with the students early on, the idea was that once the first generation of students involved took ownership, they would then evolve and craft the town for themselves and take more and more explicit control, which they did, to the point where, Natasha, I remember going away for a few days in about the third year to go and deliver a conference speech, actually. And I came back and the students told me that they decided that they were going to remodel the ICT suite because they decided they no longer needed one because we had wireless technologies and laptops and what have you. And they said that the town needed a performance space and nightclub. So so they decided that's what... But, I mean, it was great.
With
so
what
you imagine,
benefit? With what benefit?
Well, let me tell you. So at lunchtimes, rather than just kind of endlessly scratching around on the playground, or for the boys that like playing soccer, they could play soccer. For the girls who wanted to do dance routines, they could do dance routines. And for the rest, they'd huddle in a corner waiting for the wind to go. They would have a space which at lunchtimes they could go to where our children who were musicians or budding stand-up comedians could do a set. There would be soft drinks on offer and a few snacks, and the kids would be able to go in, chill out, and listen to some of their colleagues doing their thing.
Unreal. I'm going back to school. Now, look, you take on a lot. You take on the physical environment of schools. I think that's a really profound argument because an awful lot of schools look like prisons, I often think. You
Absolutely.
Also take on this standardised approach to education, a national curriculum, national testing. And that, you feel, doesn't encourage the kind of flexible and individual learning that you support. But isn't that also a fundamental way of getting quality control in a mass education system? Millions of students, millions of schools, how do you measure?
Well, look, there's no doubt that schools need to be accountable. You know, we're dealing with the most valuable human beings, the most valuable human assets on earth, our children. And for a large number of people, that either are outlaying for private education or taxpayers' money. So there's no doubt the system needs to be accountable. But the problem we live in at the moment is a world which is a vicious cycle, right? No one has actually said that we need to look at the way we're assessing our students. So what we're doing is constantly designing our systems with a already defined fixed outcome, which limits our opportunity to truly revision the system. Because, of course, what the tendency then is to say, well, how do we get more kids through formal qualifications rather than saying, let's design a new education system and then find a way to hold it to account? Look, it's a bit like telling a really famous chef that they can use any ingredients they like to create something new as long as it looks like and tastes like that cake.
Where do you see the role of evidence in designing the sorts of programs that you've designed? Good evidence and on what measures?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, if we're looking at developing young people to fit the profile of need, not just for the 21st century, you know, I often find that argument a bit spurious, given that some of the children who are being born today, given the advances in medical science, will be alive in the 22nd century. We need to listen to guys like Steve Wozniak and major organisations. We need to look at the reports produced by organisations like the OECD. Now, before anyone who's in education coughs into their coffee this morning because the OECD produced those horrendous PISA International League tables, they also produce some very interesting reports into the links between education, employment and skills. And in their last major global report in 2013, they cited that the countries that are fixated with formal qualifications in their education system are the countries where young people are going to increasingly find employment opportunities more and more difficult. So what we need to do is we need to create a system which, first of all, really explores the detailed skills and competences our young people need, not just to survive, but thrive in that future. And then find a way to hold that system to account. You know, we are incredibly intelligent human beings. There is no reason why we shouldn't design an approach and then find a way to hold it accountable.
Well, very interesting set of ideas, and we could talk for a full hour. I wish we'd had you for the whole show and talk back. But look, great to have you. Good luck with your presentation tomorrow. I'm sure you've sown the seeds for an interesting debate on our Facebook page, I hope. Richard Gerver, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Richard Gerver is the author of Creating Tomorrow's Schools Today, published by Bloomsbury, and he's speaking at a major education conference in Victoria. We will have a link to that on our website. And love your thoughts. Get on our Facebook page if you can. And our listener feedback line is 02 833 1430, or you can comment on the story on our website. Up next, we're heading to Afghanistan.
Now hear this, and to my horror, I see a pair of knickers.
Telling true stories in front of a room full of strangers.
Huge policeman pulled up our driveway, and of course the neighbours all came.
Excuse me, miss, you've dropped something.
Now hear this.
And it began, "Dear Mr. Robotham, I read a review of your novel in Gun Lovers Digest. And so I picked it up, and I got to page 29.
You can download Now Hear This from the RN website.
Well, my next guest might prompt you to pause and think more closely about the skin you're in, about your social value, and who determines that in the society you live in. We're crossing to New York en route to Afghanistan to hear this incredible story when investigative journalist Jenny Nordberg herself went to Afghanistan to research a television story on Afghani women. She stumbled across a hidden story of hidden lives. Her investigations have led to a profound book, I have to say, The Underground Girls of Kabul, The Hidden Lives of Afghan Girls Disguised as Boys. Jenny is the foreign correspondent for the Swedish national newspaper Svenska Dagbladet, and she's also an investigative journalist working for US publications, including the New York Times, and she joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Welcome to ABC Radio National, Jenny.
Thank you so much.
What took you to Afghanistan back in 2009? What was the story that you were pursuing?
Well, I came late to this war of my generation in 2009. I had learned a lot about the women there under the Taliban, and then this idea with which we all, as in the Western world and the aid organizations and the military and the diplomats, went in there and tried to change Afghan society. It was even a justification for the war at one point in the United States that we were to liberate women, you know, and they were to toss their burqas, and things were going to become much different for women in there. And I was curious to see how that had gone and what was at the root of extreme gender oppression in Afghanistan. So that's how I first came to do a story there.
And you start the story with meeting an incredible woman, a female parliamentarian, Azita. Tell us about Azita, because this is really where this whole hidden story begins.
Yes, I was speaking to all kinds of women in my research, activists and politicians, and you know, women who had risen to power and some prominence, or and women who were educated and had started to build lives for themselves after the Taliban. And Azita was one of them. She was one of the female parliamentarians in the new government instituted after the Taliban left. There was an instituted 25% quota of women, so there were very few women, and she was one of them. And And I had called her up essentially and asked if I could speak to her because she seemed interesting. Mm-hmm. And she said, of course, I, you know, come to my house. And I took her up on that and I arrived at a neighborhood in Kabul, not really knowing what to expect. And there I spoke to her twin daughters, her 10-year-old daughters in one of the rooms of the apartment where she was taking a phone call in the other room.
And they whispered something to you.
Yes, they spoke a little bit of English, and we had a basic conversation going. And one of them said, you know, our brother is really a girl. And I looked at her and I was sort of like, uh-huh. Mm. And then the other girl became a little bit irritated that I had no strong reaction to this reveal. And she said, no, it's true. She's our sister. And with that, I had a few thoughts running through my mind. I thought that maybe I had misheard or that we had some kind of a language issue or maybe that I had just missed something in my education on Afghanistan. Maybe this was something that was going on there because I knew that they had a younger brother and I wasn't quite sure what they were talking about. But I kept face, as you do as a journalist, trying to really not show any emotion and as though nothing is strange to you. But I didn't dare bring it up with Asita when we finally got to talk because I thought that if this was true, maybe this was a family secret.
Mm. Who was the little brother that you did meet?
Oh, he showed up a few minutes later, walking into the room with short hair, a denim shirt, shooting a toy gun at me, looking exactly like the 10-year-old sisters, although a younger 6-year-old version, and also very different from them. Whereas the twin girls were very giggly and girly and very feminine, this was a whole different character. This was clearly a boy, a whole different body language, hips forward, you know, in more of a traditional aggressive manner. So to me, it looked completely like a boy.
Mm. A made-up son is better than none at all. This is a recurring statement through this book. And in fact, this little boy was indeed the sister of these twin daughters. And his name was Mehran, is that right?
Mehran, who had become Mehran from initially being Manush, which is a girl's name. But then when she was turned into a boy at about 5 years old, her name was tweaked to sound more like that of a boy.
What did Asita tell you about the choice that she had made, that their family had made, to transform this little girl into a little boy?
Oh, she explained it in a very matter-of-fact way. She said that, first of all, it was problematic for me as a parliamentarian. I was always questioned as to why I didn't have a son. I only have 4 daughters. And since it is incumbent upon every woman in Afghanistan, since it's a deeply patriarchal society, to bear at least 1 son, she was being questioned, you know, what can you really accomplish as a politician when you can't even have a son in your family? Mm-hmm. Your family is weak and you know, we question you. That was one reason. And the second reason was that it afforded more freedom of movement for all of the daughters, because now with the youngest brother, they could be escorted by this child and they could get out more. They could see more of the sky and, you know, get out and play. So it became a practical solution for the family. And thirdly, she told me, and this, of course, I found very interesting. She said, I wanted to show my youngest what life was like on the other side.
Because, in fact, she revealed at some point that she'd done the same herself as a child. She'd lived for a short time as a boy and felt that those boy years had helped her.
She did, and this took, I think it was more than a year into knowing her when she finally revealed this to me. It was when I started to question her. I said, you know, how do we know that this works? How do you feel about this? What's going to happen to Mehran? You know, what are the effects that it's going to have on her? And what if it will be difficult for her later on in life? And she said, I would share this with you that I was actually a boy at one point, and she was a boy to help out in her father's store in 1980s Kabul. So she had the same experience, and she felt that this was something that opened up the world to her, empowered her. She had the experience of speaking to men, and it actually helped her in her political life.
So this all made you very curious, and you started sleuthing, didn't you, to see how widespread this might be. What did you discover?
Well, I was immediately interested to see if there were others. Was this just a very creative solution by one family, or was this something that was going on in Afghanistan? Because what would that then say about society at large there? And I did find that every Afghan I spoke to knew of someone like this. They would have such a child in their own family, in the extended family. Maybe a great-grandmother was known to have, you know, ridden horses and have been a great sharpshooter. There's usually one in a school. Doctors will know about this. Midwives, teachers are familiar with the phenomenon. Neighbors will know of someone. So it's impossible to say how many there are, because we don't even know how many people there are in Afghanistan. It's not a place where you can take a census, but it's not uncommon. It's almost like a shared deceit or a don't ask, don't tell kind of thing.
In some cases, though, the girl had been turned into a boy early on because there was a belief that that would have magical benefits for a family desperately trying to have a boy. Such is the value of boys in Afghanistan.
Yes, this is another reason. Every family will have their own reason. What they share is this absolute need for a son. And the magical or superstitious, if you will, component of this is prevalent in many families. You can translate it to something that we see as a little bit of new age, as in, which is old age, of course, in this part of the world, where if you see something in front of you every day, it will eventually manifest into something real. So it will affect the mother, and she will give the woman, and she will give birth to a son next. And quite a few girls who I met, or even grown women, had this that they wanted to have a son in the family, so they designated a girl to look like one until a son was born in the family.
Mm. You went on to meet not just children, but also adolescents and adults. And we'll get to the adults because I think they're very interesting, the case studies that you talk to here. But puberty, I mean, how far do families take this shared deceit, as you describe it? And perhaps the story of Zara is illustrative here. Incredible story about how she had been transformed, not just externally, but internally by this experience.
Yes. Well, Zara was, I think she was about 2 years old. It's unclear. They don't really know. When she was designated as the family son in order for her mother to bear actual sons. And she grew up like a boy and eventually a young man. In most cases, these girls are turned, the tomboys, if you will, they're turned into young girls and women because that's when they're supposed to become proper Afghan girls and get married and have children, ideally sons of their own. So it's very important for them then to take the traditional role of a young Afghan woman. Mm. Some girls push it further than that, and most cannot. But Zara is someone who just doesn't want to turn back, and she's been able to hold out a little longer than what is usual in Afghan society in these families. And she told me when I spoke to her the very first time, she said, I see how women are treated here. Why would I want to be one of them? Mm. So she's grown up riding a bike, and she has an exaggerated, hunched way of walking, and she also looks completely like a young man, and she's interested in sports, and she doesn't do any cooking, and she tries to lower her voice when she speaks and just disappear into a crowd in order to hold out as long as possible for the freedom of movement and for the rights, frankly, that every human should have, but they're not afforded women in Afghanistan.
When you spoke to her at 15 or 16, she just strikes me, Jenny, as a wise old soul when it comes to understanding how gender works in Afghanistan.
Yes, I will say that as much as we have come there many times with our ideas of gender and equality and freedom and human rights and all that, I learned so much about these things from Afghans because they have a very clear view of what rights they have and what they don't have, and in terms of gender, because they're left to themselves to figure all this out, and they are involved in this very real nature versus nurture experiment when they have to reflect on gender and who they are and what they've become. I mean, the irony of the society is that it's so segregated, and women are supposed to look and behave like very traditional, you know, almost cliche-like women, and on the other side, men. The irony of that is that it's also easier to switch because you just adopt all the very traditional outward behavior and looks of the other gender. Mm. So it's not as jumbled as it can be sometimes in our society where, you know, women wear pants and have short hair and, you know, do traditional men's jobs. No, it's not like that. So many times they study the other gender and they know exactly what that's like and what's typical for a man and what's typical for a woman. And those are things that Zara, for instance, explained to me. She's deeply entrenched in the honor culture, for instance. As a man or a young man, she sees herself as someone who is to protect her younger sisters, for instance.
Yeah, her story is incredible. And she was, you know, very articulate, it seems, about never, ever wanting to live as a girl again. Jenny Nordberg is with me this morning on Life Matters. She is an investigative journalist based in New York, and her book is The Underground Girls of Kabul, The Hidden Lives of Afghan Girls Disguised as Boys. Jenny, amongst the adults that you met, there was, I think, Shukriya, and she was a woman who had played at being a boy right up to just a month before her wedding night. What toll did that have on her sense of identity as a married woman?
I was trying to find out essentially what had stayed with these women, and most women had only had this experience as children, but Shukriya was, I think she was 33 when I first spoke to her. She's a married mother of three, and she had never talked to anyone about this before. Once I, you know, was introduced to her and we began talking, she pulled out pictures of herself as a young man, and they were striking. You could never have guessed that it was, in fact, a woman. Mm. And she really tells the story that you can read in academic books about how gender is formed in a person, because the way she describes it, without having, you know, not very much education or having read authors or philosophers like Judith Butler or anything like that, is that the way she expresses it is that the male stuck in her. The male is the natural thing. It will never go away. Even though she's now married, she's given birth, she recognizes that she's a mother, she has these instincts still that she was taught very early on to, you know, to defend women and to be very physical and to walk in a very determined way and to speak up and look people in the eye. Again, things that we may think of as natural and normal to us, but that you just don't do if you're an Afghan woman, because the culture is not like that. Women are supposed to take very small steps and have a small physical presence and, you know, at all times be beholden to men. But Shukriya, it's not like that to her, because she thinks of herself as Shukur. And Shukur was a young man in a leather jacket and a pair of jeans who roamed around Kabul with her gang.
So has that taken its toll on her?
Well, very much so. I mean, she describes it as though she's almost stuck between two genders, and she's not a full woman and she's not a full man. So there's definitely that confusion. I think it's important also at the same time to remember that in a place like Afghanistan, with constant war and insecurity, I mean, trauma is described even in a different way than it would be to us, because she's grown up in an extremely difficult environment, and she also works as an emergency nurse at one of the hospitals in Kabul. So she sees this every day. And the gender thing is something that lives in her and that she is upset about and that she's tortured about. But there's just no time for that. Mm. You know, it's she has to take care of her family. She has to feed her children. So it's a conversation that she's having with herself and had her whole life, and eventually with me, which I'm very thankful for, because she's a very brave woman to speak about this. Mm. But it's not something that she has been able to, you know, see a psychologist about or to explore in any way where she has been able to, as we would maybe think, process this or deal with it. It just lives in her.
Did any of the women that you spoke to express bitterness about the choice that had been made on their behalf by their parents to make them a boy, essentially, for a phase of their life? And perhaps because of the difficulty of that transition back to an oppressed existence, a very indoors existence as an Afghani woman?
Yes, and Shukriya was one of these women. She said that I would never do this to my daughter. She has one daughter and two sons. And I wish my parents hadn't done it to me because I eventually had to become a woman. I mean, it would have been fine if I had been able to live my whole life as a man, or, you know, that would have been better. But now when I was forced into this role of a woman that I had never known, she had no idea even how to greet women, how to, you know, kiss them on the cheek, how to talk to women, how to walk like a woman. It was like she had to be born again when she was 20 years old.
Mm. You did meet women who were still living as men, as adults, didn't you?
Yes. And in those cases, and again, they are completely, you know, you cannot distinguish these women from another Afghan man.
And I just have to wonder where the experience of the so-called bachelor posh, this description of girls who live as boys, and then a kind of queer identity, perhaps as a gay woman or a queer woman, begins.
Yes. I mean, I found it very difficult to apply our terms and our knowledge and what, you know, what existing research we have onto Afghans. And I actually tried this on a number of experts in, you know, in psychology and neurology and all those fields. And they said it's very difficult to translate what we define, what we have, you know, made up as a definition for something to someone, again, who's grown up in war, who's had a completely different experience. And this is a nature versus nurture experiment that we really don't know much about, because if you think of it, these girls and women were also picked at random to grow up as boys. So it approaches some very interesting questions to which, unfortunately, I have no answers about, you know, can gender confusion or whatever, you know, name you want to put on this, be created? Well, maybe it can in a person. It certainly seems so. But then again, you cannot take one of these women and put them into our categories of, you know, you fulfill all these criteria for being a certain something or having a certain something, or, you know, maybe that there's not even anything wrong with you in our sense. Because what is really wrong with wanting to walk out the door and to, you know, to live freely and to have some control over your own body.
To be actually able to walk out the door on your own, an incredible
liberation.
Yeah,
I mean, is that a symptom or a disease?
Mm. Yeah, that's right. This is a very complex terrain, as you've illustrated. And, you know, when Westerners take this on as the issue du jour in terms of Afghanistan, and you see Afghani women queuing at elections with burqas on, for example, how do you think about the situation for these girls who live as boys, and the bigger story about women in Afghanistan at this stage of its history?
I have a few thoughts on that. It took me a while to come to this, but as strange as this is or may seem at the outset, it also makes complete sense. This is what women have always done throughout history. This is what has existed in our own history.
Mm. Globally.
Where women couldn't, you know, they couldn't have an education, they couldn't become doctors, they couldn't go to war. They disguised themselves as something other. I mean, this is what every oppressed group has done and are still doing when it comes to, you know, religion or ethnicity or even sexual orientation. You had to pretend to be something else. It's a human phenomenon. So it's not that strange or it's not that far away. And again, I think with all our ideas are almost our own thinking that we invented things like freedom and equality and all those things. I mean, Afghan women have a very clear idea of the freedoms that they don't have. And I think that to us, it's been so important to try and help and try and change this because it's so close for us as women in our own history, not having any rights, you know, not having any control over our own bodies and, you know, not having the right to vote, not having any say, no financial power, and certainly no political power. So to see this going on right now is infuriating. And we, you know, we all wanted this to change much more quickly than it actually has. Mm-hmm. So in essence, I think that You know, we are them and they are us. And the reason why we have been so involved and eager to change Afghan society, and many times not very successfully, it's just that, you know, we think of it as something very exotic, something very far away. But in fact, it's so close to us. Mm. It's, you know, this is our grandmothers. It's my grandmother, certainly, and my great-grandmother, for sure.
Yes, in your description of the actual reality of having as many women in parliament as they do in Afghanistan is very sobering as well. This is a very powerful investigation you've written. And I thank you very much for joining us, Jenny, to discuss it on Life Matters here on ABCRN. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jenny joined us from the studios of Radio Foundation in New York. Her book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, is published by Hachette. Details on the Life Matters website. Really quite something. Well, on Life Matters with me, Natasha Mitchell, on ABCRN, when did that become a thing? Coming next. How do you feel about doing absolutely nothing? Does even the thought of that make you feel a little uneasy, overwhelmed by that constant nagging feeling that you should be doing something? There was a time when we could do nothing and not feel we had to reach for our phone. Do we let ourselves be bored anymore? Have we always experienced boredom in the same way? Here's the next in our How Did That Become a Thing series on the little histories we take for granted with Susan Mousehart. Take it away, Louie.
My story is much too sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. Yes.
Boredom, like beauty or conjunctivitis, is in the eye of the beholder. What for one person is like watching paint dry is for another, well, not what you'd expect.
It's a much bigger world than you think out there when it comes to paint.
Take Kristen Garland. Kristen's a color consultant, and she owns a custom paint store in Fremantle. I spoke to her while she was on a job the other day.
Oh, I'll go and stand in the shade. That's the plastic sheeting.
She had just finished applying an iron ore-based paint and was sitting there waiting for it to, well...
And is it true that part of your job is to watch paint dry?
Well, you have to.
Yeah. I get a kick out of you.
When you delve into this side of paint, it's fascinating. You've only got a certain window of time, I suppose, where you apply separate coats.
So are you saying that it can actually be kind of suspenseful?
Very. Sometimes you take your heart in your hand.
Obviously, boredom can be hard to pin down. Boredom is really an umbrella term for a whole variety of emotional states, ranging all the way from disgust to mild euphoria.
Yes,
but here's something you may never have thought about. Boredom wasn't always a thing. There was a time when it didn't exist. I sounded really excited when I just said that. That's probably because I was exaggerating. I always get excited when I exaggerate.
Next Thursday on Louie...
About you, but I'm old enough to remember a time when toddlers didn't need iPads to keep them occupied in the car, when their mums and dads could withstand the tedium of a red light without batting an eye, let alone an iPhone. Do you remember when people went on holiday in order to do nothing and liked it?
Yeah, baby.
In 1959, an article in the Harvard Business Review lamented that boredom, which used to bother only aristocrats, has become a common curse. 1959. Really? But it's not just boredom that's had its historical highs and lows. It's all emotions.
Emotions do have a history. There are emotions that we find early on in European history that don't exist now.
That was Dr. Juanita Ferris-Rise, a researcher with the ARC Center for the History of Emotions. Juanita explained to me that the culture we live in really does shape how we feel. It's a bit like a prism. Change the angle, and things take on a totally different color.
What happens is some societies enable certain sorts of emotions to come to the fore. Others don't.
Dr. Peter Tuohy, whom you just heard speaking to me from his home in Canada, is probably the world's foremost historian of boredom. Yep, there are others. Peter pointed out to me that, sure, people have always experienced lack of stimulation, but how they responded to that, whether they ever perceived it as a problem, well, that's where we see big shifts over time. We'll hear more from Peter in a bit, but first, who were boredom's founding fathers? I put the question to Juanita. And, well, blame it on memories of interminable pre-Vatican II Latin masses, but I wasn't really that surprised to learn the answer.
It was something that was very specific to medieval monks out in the desert, so they were living quite a deprived ascetic life. This particular emotional state was known as the noonday devil.
The technical term for this holiness fatigue was acedia, and it was a serious business if you were a monk. It ranked right up there with lust and gluttony as one of the seven deadly sins. Which is weird, because that makes it sound as if boredom were some sort of, I don't know, guilty pleasure. As if there were people who actually enjoyed being bored.
I am James Ward, and I like boring things. I like boring things so much that I, as Julian said, I am the founder of the Boring Conference. It's a day sort of dedicated to the mundane, the ordinary, the obvious, and the overlooked.
Who else but an Englishman could make a career out of boredom? Although, to be fair, Ward's tagline and the title of his popular blog, I Like Boring Things, is evidently a quote from Andy Warhol, of all people. But whatever. Ward's thrill-packed posts examine topics like peas and stationery and building plastic models. And he holds a boring conference in London each year.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board.
As for boredom, we didn't even have a word for it until 1852. Its first appearance in print, some say appropriately, was in Dickens' super long serial Bleak House. But most historians agree that boredom burst onto the scene a full century earlier, during the period we call the Enlightenment. But then, what didn't burst onto the scene during the Enlightenment?
Everything was invented then. Leisure, boredom, jealousy, the modern concept of time, and so on and so on.
That's Dr. Peter Tuohy again, a professor of history at the University of Calgary. His book, Boredom, A Lively History, was published by Yale University Press in 2011. Well, Peter divides boredom into two categories. Hang on, is that boring?
To start with, there's this, the simple form, which I've defined as it's an emotion of mild disgust produced by temporarily unavoidable and predictable circumstances.
I'm bored. I'm so bored.
The boredom of the child or the animal is a simple boredom.
Now, this kind of boredom probably arose as a protective mechanism to keep human beings on the alert and moving forward.
Bored.
Complex boredom, which is the variety that arose alongside the Industrial Revolution, is sometimes also described as existential boredom.
It's usually defined like this. It's a powerful and unrelieved sense of emptiness and isolation, in which an individual feels a persistent lack of interest in and connection to his circumstances.
This modern form of boredom was associated almost exclusively with the leisured class.
Look at all the captivating, fascinating things there are to do.
Name two.
Because if there's one absolutely essential precondition to boredom, it's spare time. People toiling in a subsistence economy, you know, peasants, serfs, single parents, they don't have the luxury of feeling bored.
You can hear every tree almost saying, look at me.
What color are the trees?
Green.
What color were they last year?
Green.
And next year?
Green.
It's a bore.
Technology has been another key factor in the equal distribution of boredom. The mechanical clock, for example, developed in the 13th century, which made time visible, measurable, and capable of weighing heavily on our hands. The printing press in the 15th century, because literacy encouraged introspection, my mother called it moping, as well as the idea that the mind, left unattended, was an empty vessel or a blank slate needing to be filled up. The electric light bulb, which handed humanity a huge second helping of time, literally overnight. And the internet, of course, which is ratcheting up our appetite for quote-unquote stimulation to previously unimaginable and arguably pathological new levels. Juanita Ferris-Rise sees boredom as the price of freedom, of having lives that are self-determining, rather than dictated by church or ironclad custom. Other research suggests that there's a problem no matter which end of the option spectrum you're at, you know, whether you have too few or too many. Like the problem of having 70 toys in your closet, evidently the average number for an American child. Joshua Becker of the blog Being Minimalist mulled that one over on HuffPost Live recently.
I don't remember being nearly as bored as my son is with all the things that he has, right? Like you knew your discontent wasn't going to be solved by buying another toy or getting another video game, but you had this set of toys and you're going to have to make it work one way or the other.
But here's something else that's exciting about boredom. All of a sudden, it's also become a thing to study. All kinds of people are researching boredom these days, not just historians, psychologists, neuroscientists. As a result, we're learning some pretty startling facts about the dangers of boredom.
Boredom not only can kill you in the form of suicide, boredom is a key indicator of depression. It has a disastrous impact on all aspects of life.
See, that proves my point. That was from a recent documentary titled Hello, Boredom. But we're also hearing, and this may surprise you, about boredom's brighter side, if you will, about its role in stimulating creativity and innovation. German researcher Thomas Goetz, for example, has identified 5 types of boredom. And I'm not going to go into that because it's kind of boring, but one of those types, he calls it the calibrating variety, is a really good kind of boredom. It's characterized by wandering thoughts and general openness. It's been said that the cure for boredom is curiosity, and that there's no cure for curiosity. I wish I'd said that. It was Dorothy Parker. But others see boredom as a necessary precondition for curiosity. I mean, if you're never bored, you never have a space to be curious.
Neuroscience is finding that when we are idle, when we are bored, when we are not distracted or focused on something else, our brains are actually most active.
Okay, that was one of the least boring people you'll ever meet. She's Bridget Schulte, a reporter for The Washington Post and author of a book that exploded like a ticking time bomb earlier this year. It's called Overwhelmed: Love, Work, and Play When No One Has the Time. It's about the cult of busyness, that whole I have no time to live my life epidemic that seems to afflict all of us in the age of email. I rang up Bridget pretty much out of the blue. I do stuff like that when I'm bored, because I was curious to know if she saw our love affair with being busy as a kind of antidote to our fear of boredom.
You know, I would say they're almost more the same thing. Both of them take you out of being fully present in yourself and fully present in the moment.
Listening to her, it occurred to me, hey, when did busyness become a thing? Okay, I'm working on it. Sheesh, never a dull moment around here.
She said we were never feeling bored, 'cause we were never being boring. We had too much time to find for ourselves, and we were never being boring. We dressed up in thoughts and thoughts make amends, and we were never holding back, worried that
Oh, yes. Any excuse to play the Pet Shop Boys on morning radio. Susan Mousehart and her very unboring little history of boredom. Oh, I'm quite puffed. Been dancing in the studio. The next instalment in our How Did That Become a Thing series of Susan's. More to come, of course. And there is a cracker feature from Susan on our homepage, abc.net.au/rn. It is a classic. Let me just read you one line from it. Boredom, like beauty or conjunctivitis, is clearly in the eye of the beholder. I'll leave that thought with you as I come to Michael Williams this morning. Oh, I've got to get my breath.
Natasha, I love a segue from conjunctivitis to myself. It always makes me happy.
I've been dancing around the studio and I am doing our fitness challenge, I have to say, so I should not be puffed at this point. You've got a fantastic children's writer on today.
We do. The Antidote of Boredom is a good children's writer, and that's we've got Graham Bass in the studio today. It'll be lovely to talk to him. It's been many years since Animalia, and barely a year goes by without another masterpiece from Graham.
So. And he's taking us to Angkor Wat, Cambodia.
He is a man who's travelled seems to directly inform what he writes, and so we're going to find out a bit more of that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. What else have you got coming up?
We've also got, still on the school holiday theme, Arena Theatre and Melbourne Theatre Company have come together to put on a new show called Marlon, which is fantastic for kids.
Looking forward to it. Graham Bass coming up straight after the news on Books and Arts Daily. And we have a fantastic show for you next too. It's 10 a.m. Here's the news.
Suzanne Corey, former president of the Australian Academy of Science, a renowned medical researcher, has shown what a woman can achieve. But why should the path be so difficult?
We have a major science brain drain in this country, a very concerning loss of women from careers in science, technology, engineering and maths. How can we hope to compete internationally if we're losing so much creativity?
The Boyer Lectures. You can download these lectures from the RN website.